It's time for the February Hot Pocket, Melvis.
We've decided on a new name, Hot Pockets. I love it. Oh, the pockets that are hot. It's so exciting.
We've got a lot of stuff coming up this month. MRAP on the road, on the plane, on the sea, the long-awaited Stanford Conference, March 6th through 10th in Maui. You, Jess, Josh Kay, our sound designer, and I will all be there doing our usual nonsense. So actually, we're going to be doing some unusual nonsense as well.
We're going to be actually doing some education and some nonsense. So, it's kind of a new thing for us.
Can it just be straight nonsense?
Nonsense needs to be tainted. Tainty nonsense, I think we're going to call it from now on. Yeah, I've got to tell you about a few things too, though, Rob. First of all, I believe today, I'm going to go out on a limb today, I am told that video comes to the MRAP website. So the MRAP HD videos, inline videos in this written summary. So let's say we're talking about, I don't know, pelvic fractures, and you need to know how to understand the different types of pelvic fracture. Boom, inline videos coming today. I hope it happens. Otherwise, I'm going to look like an idiot again. Also, I got a back passage coming this week. Did you enjoy the first back passage? Well, here's another back passage. It's as if there are two back passages. And this one's a little bit about our sound designer, Josh Kay, who is a genius and also quite strange. I quite love it. And that's not all, Rob. I'm starting a session on burnout. And the first one is about my experience dealing with consultants and how I dealt with it and how it's wrong. That's all I got for you. You got anything?
Well, before we get to the meat and potatoes of this hot pocket, we're going to do challenge coins first rather than at the end, since what we've got for the main educational chunk, it's extra chunky, it's extra big. So what do we have this month?
Well, this month's shout out goes to Dr. Alan Heber, who, from the sound of this nomination, is retiring after 34 years in said business of emergency medicine.
You say it Heber? Heber? Heberer?
Heber? Heberer?
H-E-B-E-R-E-R?
Heber. Alan Heberer?
Dr. Heberer has seen it all. His ED went from small to very busy, like a lot of our EDs, and he's been a leader and all that sorts of thing. But the real magic, it's a very long nomination, but the real magic of it is on the micro level.
So we're told that throughout his career, he maintained the same smile, the jovial personality, and the god-awful, in quotes, work ethic. He's remained one of the top five producers at this group for 34 years. He's served as a mentor to nearly every single physician in that department. He's taught us many useful clinical pearls and bestowed upon us several life lessons, even if we did not want to hear them, apparently. I can only wish that I can emulate his desire to learn and to make such an impact on our specialty.
Dr. Heberer Challenge Coin is in the mail, and if you, that is you, listening right now, the listener, if you have someone you'd like to nominate for an MRAP Challenge Coin, if you'd like to recognize their excellence in humanity and emergency medicine practice, just scroll down to the bottom of the website. It's at the very bottom, so after you've logged on, of course, click where it says Challenge Coins, and it'll take you to the Challenge Coin page, and from there, pretty self-explanatory.
We'll take care of the rest, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. These are important. These are important. Send them in.
Let's get educated. Flu season is in full swing in the Northern Hemisphere. That's actually a pandemic in our region, and always a bit of uncertainty about who should and shouldn't get meds, if anyone should get them at all, who should get tested, who should get nothing but supportive care. And guess what? Our man Cam Burke has an ADP on this very thing. Actually, a flu season ADP.
Before we really get into the meat of the ADP, I want to talk a little bit about the background. And so, Rob, I am not a research genius. I'm not an academician. I'm not a methodologist. But, I enjoy reading the occasional article. And over the last 10 years, I've really been fascinated by this topic. Many of the listeners probably know much about this, but I think it's important that we lay out the evidence-based stage for their conversation. I think we all know about the flu. I mean, influenza has been a problem throughout modern history. It's common. It's occasionally lethal. It occurs worldwide annually in epidemic patterns. And there have been a lot of different attempts over the decades to develop disease-specific therapy. But most drugs simply haven't ended up working. So supportive care has been the mainstay. You have the flu, it may get worse, but you'll probably be miserable for about a week and then get better. In the 70s and 80s, there were this class of drugs called amantadines, and they were historically used in the flu and worked against the flu virus. But we learned in clinical practice that patients developed resistance to these very quickly. And currently, a large amount of influenza is de novo resistant to amantadines, and that which isn't develops very quick resistance in the setting of therapy. So let's just leave that behind. We're not going to talk about them. Those drugs simply don't work. So So really, there's only one class of medications that we have, and those are the neuraminidase inhibitors. The issue of antiviral treatment specifically came to the forefront back in 2009. Do you remember 2009, Rob?
I remember 2009 for many reasons, but mostly the H1N1 pandemic.
That was the year of the dreaded swine flu pandemic. It was actually endemic throughout the world at that point, and it ended up being a very widespread outbreak that wasn't particularly lethal when compared to historical catastrophic events like 1918. However, the relevant outcome from 2009 was the very widespread public health recommendation that governments and agencies should stockpile these drugs, these neuraminidase inhibitors. And at that time, the WHO, the CDC, and the EMA, which is basically the European CDC, all published basically the same guidelines wherein they recommended the widespread treatment for influenza. For most of us, the agent that we use is oseltamivir or Tamiflu, and that's the one that's been studied the most. There's a couple other drugs we should at least mention. Zanamivir is a very similar drug that's given via an inhaled route, so it's kind of an aerosolized antiviral. It's available, but of course, it's a little bit more challenging to administer and store, and so we don't use it nearly as often. And then in the last couple of years, you've probably seen in the trade publications that there's a third drug out there. It's called Paramivir, which is almost identical in terms of its activity and efficacy, but it's given via a single IV administration. I really am going to encourage people to look beyond that drug as well. It costs about $800 per dose, and the literature base for it is all about non-inferiority compared to Tamiflu. So it's not a particularly blockbuster drug. So why do we spend all this time on this intro? Well, since 2009, the literature has evolved, and there's been a really interesting, dedicated group of researchers from the Cochrane Collaboration that was digging into the foundational literature surrounding these recommendations to use neuraminidase inhibitors widespread for epidemic influenza. And I really would encourage anybody who's interested in kind of these public health and big pharma conversations to dig into this. The Cochrane Collaboration has an awesome publication, and the BMJ has actually partnered with them on a lot of this. So essentially what the researchers have found is that two of the pharma companies, those are Roche and GlaxoSmithKline, of course we get no money from them. We have nothing against them, but they were naughty and they profited quite handsomely from some pretty devious behavior. So essentially what these two companies did is they conducted 107 different randomized trials, and they did these in different populations like healthy adults, healthy kids, sick adults, sick kids. And these were typical kind of phase three pharma trials. Most of them were pretty small. Some of them were big, but the important outcome is they suppressed a lot of the trial data. So out of the 107 trials that were conducted, only 20 some ever went to press. And most importantly, the 53 trials that were probably the biggest and certainly had negative outcomes were quite clearly suppressed. So basically these trials were registered, there was government awareness that they were going on, and then the literature never came out and the results were never given to researchers. So overall, this is something we call publication bias. The positive outcomes get published, the negative outcomes don't. And publication bias was quite systematic when it comes to this flu therapy question. And it led to, of course, billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars being spent by governments around the world in order to stockpile these drugs. So this all comes to maturity in 2014, when after years of work, the researchers from the Cochrane Collaboration successfully petitioned various authorities to get this unpublished trial data released. And that led to an amendment to their historical guidelines and their most recent publication, which is dated 2014, and looks at the impact of antiviral therapy in suspected or confirmed flu. So overall, I just want to start with this. The treatment effect of antiviral therapy in influenza is minimal. And perhaps most frustratingly, we really don't have answers to some of the questions that we naturally ask on a daily basis and that our patients expect us to know. Here's what we do know. Treatment does very little, but it does have a slight effect. Specifically, when treatment is initiated early, typically within the first 48 hours of symptom onset, it is associated with a decreased symptom duration by about 16 hours. So does that sound pretty big to you, Rob?
When you consider that one of the main issues with taking this drug is GI effects, and it can cause an equal amount of complications potentially as it could benefit, I don't know. It seems kind of a wash, and then you're going to be spending a lot of money. It doesn't seem like much of an effect.
Exactly. So I think we'll get into that in greater detail. But essentially, the researchers found that patients are sick with influenza for about 1 week, for about 7 days, and you're going to shorten that duration by something like half a day if you give antiviral therapy early. The only other real proven benefit of antiviral therapy is that it is associated with a decreased likelihood of transmission to close household contacts. So if you treat somebody, they're a little bit less likely to shed that infectious virus and infect the loved ones who live near them. So those are the upsides of treatment. There are also some demonstrable downsides to treatment. You mentioned cost and adverse effects. That's something we always have to consider when we're thinking about any course of treatment. But perhaps more importantly, the research have shown that antiviral therapy does not affect a few things. We have fairly good evidence that antiviral therapy does not decrease the likelihood of somebody requiring hospitalization. So it doesn't fundamentally affect kind of the disease trajectory. It does not decrease the odds of death, and it does not decrease the odds of multi-organ failure. Finally, we think of avoiding secondary bacterial infections like the dreaded staphylococcal pneumonia, or we worry about kids getting otitis media or bacterial respiratory illnesses. And the trial data is quite clear that neither of these secondary endpoints is improved by the administration of therapy. It doesn't work in terms of preventing these outcomes. So now it's time to get into the details of the pathway. And really, when you and I are taking care of patients on a daily basis, they kind of sort themselves into one of two groups. They're either acutely very ill and are going to need the hospital, or much more likely, they're the well public who simply has an acute viral respiratory illness. We, of course, worry about the former much more because we want to avoid significant complications in these patients. I mean, in the chronically ill, in the elderly, the pregnant, the very young. Unfortunately, none of these so-called high-risk populations were systematically included in these trials. So we're really stuck considering therapy in these most vulnerable groups without significant evidence to base our decisions on.
All right, well, let's walk through the ADP. A patient comes in, they've got fever, they've got symptoms of a respiratory viral infection. Walk me through the steps.
So the first, and I think very obvious decision point is the patient sick enough to be admitted? And there's no magic here. If a patient is very ill, they're hypoxic, they have multi-organ dysfunction, then you should admit them. And this is our everyday bread and butter emergency medicine. I have very little to add. I'm not encouraging people to use complicated risk scores or stratification schema. Just use your judgment. If the patient needs to be hospitalized, go ahead and hospitalize them. But for the vast majority of these people, 80% or more, they're going to go home.
Patient is sick enough to admit. You isolate them. In your pathway, you get a PCR. If they have influenza, you treat them if the PCR is positive.
Yeah, that's right. So despite all of my naysaying about the effects of therapy and the benefit of therapy, there is absolutely a paucity of data on the risk and benefit of treatment in hospitalized populations. It's something that has not been studied in a randomized fashion. We're stuck with observational information. So overall, in these high-risk patients, we're recommending treatment. It's entirely possible, and I think actually probable, that treatment is not going to fundamentally help these patients. It's not going to save their lives. It's probably not going to decrease their hospital length of stay. But it's very likely that treatment will decrease the odds of secondary transmission in the hospital to staff and other patients. So please do not forget to put these patients on droplet precautions and send the influenza test. I think most of us in the hospital will have access to a PCR assay. And please, if at all possible, use that test and base your therapy on the results of the test. If the PCR is positive for influenza, treat them. If it's negative for influenza, keep them on isolation, but don't give them the antivirals.
Okay, well, what about if they're not sick? This is the overwhelming majority of patients. And I think people that are getting hospitalized, you know, you talk to the admitting docs, like, all right, well, let's get some antiviral therapy going. I mean, there's not like a lot of fight. Big controversy in the walking relatively well.
You are totally correct. The vast majority of potential influenza patients are healthy. At the beginning, I laid out the problematic literature around influenza treatment. And these are the patients that we actually have good literature about. We, in our pathway, are recommending testing and consideration of treatment really in just a very select population of potential cases, those with so-called high-risk features. This is not at all because of strong evidence, but it's rational, I think, to avoid a costly, potentially dangerous medication in healthy people who we know will not benefit. The vast majority of these trials, of course, restricted eligibility to patients with acute symptoms. That's where this kind of 48-hour cutoff comes in. And the Cochrane collaboration tried to dig into this issue around symptom duration in greater detail. And it seems like there's a very rapid diminishing benefit as measured specifically by symptom duration after 48 hours. So basically after 48 hours, there's no upside to treatment. You shouldn't even be thinking about it. So in patients who you're going to discharge, we recommend considering therapy if the symptoms have been present for less than 48 hours. Otherwise, don't even worry about it. And the patient has one of the following criterion. We found these criterion from a number of observational trials. We didn't just generate them de novo. And these seem to really be the high-risk populations. Remember, they're high risk for bad outcomes, but they're not necessarily more likely to benefit from treatment. So we're kind of off the rails when it comes to evidence here. But here's the things we picked. Chronic lung disease, and that's defined as requiring daily therapy. Neuromuscular disease, immunosuppression, pregnancy, chronic heart failure requiring daily therapy, hemodialysis, and then lastly, a compelling epidemiological consideration, such as your patient is in close contact with a high-risk individual. In these patients, so once again, symptom duration that's brief, less than 48 hours, and one of these seven high-risk features, then we recommend testing, so testing acutely. And we specifically call out that the only test should be used is a PCR assay. If you have access to that test, go ahead and obtain it, and base your treatment decision on the result of the test. If it's positive, treat them. If it's negative, don't. If you do not have access to a PCR test, and many of us, if we're working in clinic settings, will not, then just go ahead and treat them empirically. If influenza is endemic at the time you're seeing the patient, they have brief symptom duration and one of the risk factors, it's quite reasonable to go ahead and err on the side of safety and prescribe an antiviral. When we talk about the test, the other testing methodologies, and so most commonly we'll have access to things like a rapid antigen test or an ELISA test, they're so inaccurate that it doesn't even make sense to use them clinically.
I want to highlight a few points here. So even if a patient comes in with fever respiratory symptoms for 12 hours, they have the flu. They have a positive flu test. You're not treating, and you've gone over this, but this is the conversation. This is the conversation. Does patient expectation is, I want this treatment, I want the flu drug, but you're not treating. Why?
Overall, I think you can use this kind of conversation to inform the interaction you have with the patient. These medications are expensive. They have known adverse effects, and they have a very, very minimal upside. In balance, to me, it's not worth prescribing an expensive drug that is just as likely to cause adverse effects as it is to curtail symptom duration when we know that the real outcomes of consequence, like getting a severe illness requiring hospitalization or developing pneumonia, are not going to benefit from it. So in short, I really just think it doesn't make sense to treat otherwise well patients.
And what are you guys doing with little itty bitty babies? They're seen as potentially being higher risk and benefiting from treatment.
That's a very interesting conversation because we know that neonates are one of these populations that is likeliest to develop really bad illnesses from influenza. However, the Cochrane review looked at this and the pediatric subpopulation, neonates in particular, do not even have the symptom duration benefit. So we are not treating the little bitty babies.
And so not even, I can't even remember what the CDC recommendation was, like under 6 months or something. They said,
correct,
okay, consider them for treatment. But in your pathway, we don't see any signal of benefit in that patient group.
Correct. No treatment.
And then another thing that you brought up right there at the end, if there's one or more risk factors, you treat if positive. But PCR takes a very long time, very long time. And the ELISA flu test, what you said, what we've heard previously on the show, is actually no better than your gestalt in saying, yeah, it looks like you have the flu. It's flu season. Look like you have the flu. My saying that, just as good, if not better, than the ELISA test.
Exactly. Basically, every other influenza test that's commercially available, aside from the PCR, has comically poor sensitivity and specificity. And so the impact, remember, on pre and post-test likelihood ratios is so small that it simply confuses the picture. Conversely, PCR testing is actually really good, something like 98%+ sensitive and specific if you get a reasonable sample. So we like it. But if you don't have access, it's perfectly reasonable to go ahead and use your Gestalt. Please replace these other tests with your Gestalt. And you brought up the turnaround time around PCR. I hear you there. I mean, it takes for us something like 2 or 3 hours, even though we're performing them locally. This is not something to have your patient sit around in the ER waiting for the result. This is the perfect patient to have a follow-up system where we're going to get the test. If it's positive, I'm going to call you in the medication. Otherwise, you're going to go home and we'll give you a call and tell you that it's negative.
Thanks, Cam.
Thank you.